This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Franklin Lopez. He's the producer of a new film called End CIV, and you can find that at ncIV.com. Frank, I can practically feel some of my listeners shivering and saying, we're not going back to that. We're not giving up all this. I mean, I really like to have my deluxe coffee. I like to drive my car around. I like the civilization the way it is. And yet, I've had scientists on this program saying, we're going to crash anyway. And we've had peak oil experts on this program saying, this can't go on for much longer. We just don't have enough oil. If everybody lives the way we live, we need another four Earths to do it. So what do we do about this idea of collapse? And I think Derek Jensen is suggesting the sooner we kick it over, the better.
Last week, I screened the film at the COP16. And granted, I was showing the film to a group of people who are already almost there with me with the ideas of the film. One of the people just said, you know, and kind of brought up the critique of pacifism that I have in the film, and said, if we just stop participating, the system will collapse. You know, we don't have to use militant action to actually stop the destruction. And I told her that that was a very selfish position, that there are already people who are feeling the effects of the violence of civilization, you know, not to mention just how the ecological destruction is just, it's just affecting many, many people, especially in the global south. Now, we and the first world have been reaping the benefits of this violence, and you don't have to go very far south to see how our violence has been affecting people. We have the responsibility, and we have to honor all these people that we essentially, whether we knew it or not, were screwing over. And just to take a position that we just have to let it collapse, I think that shows very little foresight, in the sense that nobody really knows the future. I think that as things start to collapse, I don't think it's going to be instant. I don't think it's going to be fast. And I think as the empire, you know, being just, you know, the Western world, not just the United States, but also Canada, is going to, in acts of desperation, try to eat up more resources to keep itself alive. And I think that if we allow that to happen, the actual destruction is going to accelerate. It's not going to slow down. You know, one example of this, which I use in my film, is the Alberta tar sands. I mean, that thing is just the most insane thing in the world. You are synthetically generating oil by clearing this beautiful, massive area in a very faraway land, destroying the lifestyle of people who have been, again, living sustainably in that land for many thousands of years, so that you can run your car. And I just think this is one example. You know, you can look at hydrofracking. You can look at how deep they're trying to build wells underwater. We've already seen a huge example of this, even though all this stuff happens all the time. And, you know, one of the things that doesn't get really talked about is, like, let's just look at Nigeria and how we're destroying that country so that we can drive cars. I think that we need to look outside of our first world existence and our comfort and our desire for solar panels, which, by the way, still require raw material that needs to be mined. You know, I think people never really take those things into the equation. We need to look beyond how cushy our lifestyle is and look at how we've been destroying the world and how we've created poverty and violence around the world.
And in the film, you, along with Paul Watson and others, are pretty critical of mainstream environmental groups, including Greenpeace or people like Friends of Earth. Why? What's the problem there?
As we talked in the earlier interview, I just don't think that these groups have a full analysis on what's causing the destruction of the planet. They, to a large degree, side with the capitalists in their so-called solutions to our issues. I think the most egregious example, and is the one that I use in my film, which I wish I was making this stuff up, is the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, in which Greenpeace and David Suzuki and I think it was seven environmental groups and Canadian forest industry, I forget the exact name of it's basically the logging industry of Canada, made a deal in which, you know, supposedly a chunk of the boreal forest was going to be saved. And that's sort of questionable, but I'm not really going to get into that right now. in exchange for Greenpeace and all these other groups basically silence themselves at any criticism of boreal forest logging practices. And this agreement also requires these groups that if the Forest Products Association finds criticisms of their logging practices that are old on their websites or whatever, they are required to actually delete these things from the website. So it's almost like retroactive, right? All for what? So that the Forest Products Association can, quote-unquote, produce more sustainable or more friendly products. Again, you have the big greens facilitating capitalism there. They're facilitating this whole idea of green products, of greenwashing, where we should be really thinking about moving away from that. You know, one of the things that Derek Jensen talks about a lot, which I don't really touch upon in the film a whole lot, is this idea that personal consumer choices are going to be the way of saving the planet. When you actually look at, for instance, how much the military consumes oil or how much industry goes through water, you know, we as consumers are a tiny fraction of the larger problem. The institutions that are creating most of the destruction are outside of our out of our voting for our dollars, so to speak. And those are the institutions that need to be stopped. And this is not really talked about by Greenpeace. Greenpeace is not really talking about the military, you know, and that needs to be talked about, you know. I just think that sometimes organizations become too big for their own good, and sometimes they are too attached to the money that comes in through donations, through foundations or whatnot, to actually do the things that their original mandate was. And Greenpeace is just, you know, I pick on them just because they are probably the most visible. But, you know, you just can go down the line, you know, WWF, Forest Ethics, et cetera.
Well, you have some sacred cows that you're kicking in this film, and one of them includes Martin Luther King, it seems to me, and another one was Gandhi. You're going after some big names there. And this is one of the points where you and I do have a disagreement. We've talked about this. Derek Jensen, when he was up here in Vancouver making a speech, he told the audience that he has his own AK-47, you know. And I found that a little bit too macho. And this is a country in Canada where very few people have guns, and I kind of like it that way. So the whole idea of using violence to achieve the ends of a cleaner climate or a better world, for me, I'm against that. But in the film, you're suggesting that I'm wrong to think that way. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. I personally don't have anything against pacifism as a philosophy. And this is coming from me, who used to be a pacifist. I also don't think it has to be about being macho or anything like that. In the film, I used the example of Oka, which, briefly, Mohawks had a piece of land that was sacred to them, and the city wanted to take over that land and expand the golf course. And they tried. They tried all the different ways, you know, petitioning the government directly and whatnot. I mean, this is their land. This is their traditional land. And all other means failed. And so they took out guns, and they saved their land. And the one quote that a Mohawk woman, told the media there is, "We treat these trees and the land like our mother. These people are raping our mother. What would you do if they rape your mother?" And I think that metaphor really brings it home for us. I personally abhor violence. I abhor the violence that's being done to the planet. I abhor the violence that's being done to people all over the world. But that violence is not stopping. It's not stopping with the tools that we're using. And, you know, one of the points that I'm trying to make in the film is that all these tools have been given to us by the power structure. So the power structure is not going to give us tools that are going to be successful against them. They're going to give us tools that are going to be ineffective, but they're going to give the illusion that we live in a democratic society and that these tools are bound to work. When people tell me that they're against violence, I usually ask, "Do you have a son? Do you have a daughter?" "Yes." "Okay. What if you saw somebody assaulting your son or daughter?" the answer is almost certainly always, 99.9% of the time, I would beat the crap out of the person that's doing that to my daughter, to defend my daughter. And I said, well, you see, you just use violence. So I think that we're very comfortable in our analysis that we're pacifists and that we're nonviolent. But when it comes to the people and the things that we love, we will gladly use it. I'm applying this to the planet. And we don't have another planet. And the planet is being killed, is being raped, is being tortured, is being murdered. Our tactics are not working. We don't have unlimited time. So I'm not saying that violence is the only way. But what I'm trying to do in the film is to have this conversation that we never have, because it's taboo. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's been so beaten down our heads that to even think about violence is bad, that we don't even talk about it. Yet, at least in the United States, when you look at the heroes of the revolution, the people who kicked out the King of England, they had a resistance movement that was amazingly diverse, that used violence, but that wasn't their only tool. They used boycotts. They used all sorts of direct action that were, you know, property destruction, i.e. like inanimate objects. We have to look at all these things. We cannot discount one thing or one tool just because we need all hands on deck. And if somebody sabotages a, for instance, coal-fired power plant or stops open pit mining in the Appalachian Mountains to stop blowing off the top of a mountain for coal, I certainly support that because I think that what's at stake is it's a lot larger than anything we've ever faced before. And these are pretty big questions, and I don't expect people to agree with me on the outset. Really, what would make my film successful is not that people be in full agreement with me, but that at least they talk about these things with themselves. And I'll finally say one more thing. Maybe the film looks at Gandhi in a very heavy-handed way, but as you say, Gandhi is that sacred cow. And I'm not saying that Gandhi was wrong. Gandhi's use of nonviolence was extremely powerful. But the main point is that the movement for the independence of India was amazingly diverse, and that they won that independence by the use of all tactics. And Gandhi was just one element of that. Same thing goes to Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was amazingly successful, but he wasn't the only element. You know, there were also more militant elements that applied pressure to the power structure and eventually caused them to buckle and to enact civil rights legislation. So history doesn't really give us most of the time the full picture. And if we really want to be honest with ourselves, we have to look at the full picture. And again, this is not a point at which I arrived very easily. It took me years of mulling it over. And as somebody who was, you know, asked me 7-8 years ago if I would be having this conversation with you, I probably would be like, no, violence bad, and I just, that's the end of the story.
It's interesting to see this side of you, because in your podcast, It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, there's a certain amount of the jokester to you. You have a lot of fun with the film clips, and sometimes you blow our minds, I think. And here in this film, it's more somber, and it's more serious. The message is pretty deep. So how are you going to get this out to people? NCIV is the name of the film. How are you going to promote it? How are people going to find out about it?
I was trying to make this as not mainstream, because I know a lot of the ideas are not ever going to be mainstream, but at least as accessible to the public as possible. But in the end, like, my target audience are activists, are people who already have done a certain bit of analysis, you know, so that when they arrive at the film, they're not coming in with, you know, with very little information. I don't want to have to explain climate change to them. I want them already going there with the idea that this is a problem, right? But I'm not going to fool myself into thinking that, especially when I have a critique of, as you say, sacred cows or pacifism or whatnot, that anybody's really going to give me a large platform to do this. So I'm going on tour with the film in a very grassroots way. I'm hitting like 60 cities in North America next year. I've already done 6 screenings in Mexico this year. And then I'll be going to Europe, and then I'll be going to Australia and Japan, I hope. And on May 1st, between the beginning of the tour, which starts in February, to May 1st, I'm going to be doing a campaign promoting the launch of the film as a free download on May Day. I've had some success with getting videos out to people on the internet for more than 10 years now. And I think that this film speaks to a lot of people. And I think that once it's out there online, which, you know, may be available online before I want it to be online, but I'll just have to live with that. If I can reach 100,000 people with this film, I'll feel that it's a success, although people already tell me that I'll probably reach, you know, more than that. But, you know, one of the things that I would like to say is that, it's true. I like to laugh. I think laughter is the only thing that keeps me sane in these amazingly dire and trying times. I did try to put a couple of bits of humor in the film so that your viewers don't think that they're walking into this film with no break.
Well, it's packed with video clips that you're just not going to see anywhere else, and a lot of original interviews that you did. In fact, when I was looking at it, I was thinking, what a bear this was to make. I look at like in a minute, and there's 35 clips in it. You must have spent an immense amount of time making this.
From conception to completion, it was about 4 years. I really spent the last two, as they say in Canada, giving her. But it's, you know, it's just like all things, you know, you start with this big piece of marble and you don't know. So you just start chipping away until you start seeing the form. But once you see it accelerate, once you're seeing what you're getting, then you start getting exciting and start chipping at it faster. So yeah, so the past 2 years I've been editing more and more and more, but also like collecting a lot of the interviews and such. And then when it came down to this summer and I had pretty much all my material, it's just that I had this amazing palette, and all I had to do, it was heavenly. All I had to do is get the people who were actually funding my film, which were small donations from people who found the website, to basically buy my time, to basically help me not go and work, you know, for a client or whatnot doing video editing. And I just spent the summer just cutting, and I probably edited half the film between May and October.
Right. And what's the website for?
It's endciv.com, so ncif.com. And for viewers who have friends who only speak Spanish, there's a Spanish website too, which is FINCIV, so fincive.com.
Fincive.com?
Sí.
Sí. We'll be there. Well, it's just been a super pleasure talking with you. Franklin Lopez, he's the director, producer, and be-all of this new film, NCIV. I've looked at it. I recommend it to people. It made me think a couple times. It made me mad. A couple other times it pretty well brought me to tears to see the situation that we're in, and you get so much more of that graphically when you see these images of the tar sands and you see the images of what happened with the Aboriginal people. And I could go on for a long time, but I got a lot out of this film, so I'm recommending it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. You've just heard a sample of frustration from the anarchist camp, and it's echoing throughout the Western society. Riots, some deadly violent, have broken out in European countries and in North Africa. Do riots really accomplish anything? Not according to Forbes magazine, the self-labeled capitalist tool. Their December 22nd article, How Riots Can Influence an Economy, carefully catalogs the economic costs of violent protest. Forbes says, quote, riots with clear economic proximate causes have fortunately become very rare in the United States, though they were much more common in the early days of industrialization and unionization and the protests that accompanied the WTO conference in Seattle in 1999 were an uncomfortable reminder. If you've been a victim, your losses may be deductible. Find out how. See Deducting Disaster, Casualty, and Theft Losses. End quote. It's all tax deductible. Well, not all. There is damage to business property and some economic activity is curtailed while rocks and police fill the streets. It's hard to do one's duty as a consumer when the stores are closed. Some tourists stay away while others come for the opportunity to riot, or at least watch. And I love the slightly cynical summary Forbes magazine gives to this tactic. Quote, by and large, there is very little evidence that rioting works in the sense of leading to any lasting redress of grievances. If anything, many governments tend to respond to riots by enacting more draconian laws and beefing up the budgets of those charged with suppressing trouble. When governments do respond, it is usually just with temporary solutions designed to pacify the protesters and get them off the streets. Vague promises of redress, government-sponsored reforms, or temporary subsidies, particularly in the case of food or fuel riots, will often mollify the crowds, but seldom lead to any lasting improvement in the quality of the life of the people. End quote from Forbes. I suppose that's true enough, until the crowd overwhelmed the government, as happened in Iceland. After tossing the debt of less than 100 bankers onto the people of Iceland, the government was tossed out itself every few hundred years or so. This does happen. Then again, the poor peasants of France suffered poverty and hardship for several hundred years before rising up in their famous revolution. There is nothing to indicate North Americans will not take another 100 years to revolt. American right-wing radio is rife with rumors the American military is waiting in the wings to wade into any riots coming out of the economic crisis. 2 years after the original Pentagon study, that fear finally leaked off the internet into mainstream TV while you were Christmas shopping. It's instructive to follow the gossip, especially since the Pentagon has already announced a kind of net information warfare, which might include planting false rumors. Or are they subtly announcing a threat to jobless Americans? The sliver of information leaked out through cable news on CNBC. The date is uncertain, although the net video says November 19, 2010. Glenn Beck on Fox News quoted the same CNBC story on December 8, 2010. Conspiracist radio host Alex Jones had a field day with it, and ultra-conservative or Christian militarist net radio stations with names like, well, you know, The Warning or Morning Star or Liberty Bell, they blurted out the fearsome news. The troops who trained kicking in doors in Iraq are coming home to rule us, they say. Here is the essential clip with reporter Eamon Javers of CNBC.
And in the Army, they're having a very interesting year-long exercise called Unified Quest 2011. And in that wargaming series, they're looking at the implications of large-scale economic breakdown inside the United States that would force the Army to keep, quote, domestic order among civil unrest and force the Army to deal with fragmented global power and drastically lower budgets. This according to the trade publication InsideDefense.com. And in October, military officials from the Marine Corps War Colleges visited the trading floor of J.P. Morgan to study markets and the economy. So, Tyler, you can see that all different parts of the Pentagon and defense intelligence establishment are looking at markets and looking at ways they can present a new kind of threat to the United States. These are the guys whose job it is to think about the very worst possible things that could happen, and they've dreamed up some very scary scenarios here.
All right, Eamon, thank you very much. Eamon Javers.
If we riot, the Pentagon has apparently got the plans to put it down. They have wargamed it in a project called Unified Quest 2011. To save you hours of Googling time, here is the scoop. Spencer Ackerman wrote about Unified Quest in Wired Magazine's Danger Room back on September 15, 2010. Quote, that's where something called Unified Quest comes in. Every year, the Army's chief of staff instructs talented mid-career and senior officers and senior enlisted women or men to evaluate where the service is falling short and propose remedies. On Tuesday, about 120 soldiers and their civilian and foreign military friends, and even some Marines, swarmed onto the manicured Northern Virginia campus of mega-consultant Booz Allen Hamilton to kick off the four-day debating bull session for Unified Quest 2011 to figure out how best to cultivate the next generation of Army leaders. End quote. And the project appears to have continued at least later into the summer and perhaps until the present day. CNBC quotes the trade journal InsideDefense.com as their source for the same quotes that went out everywhere. The same few words and phrases found all over the net and in Glenn Beck came from this simple abstract rather than the full article hidden away behind a rather low paywall. Actually, you could get it for free as a sample if you're willing to sign up, but then you go on to Defense Department computers, I would imagine. This shines a sad light into journalism. Months after the event, the same few phrases are released as news without even an hour of investigation. And there are earlier versions of the same tale of the army is coming for years previously. Jim Myers wrote, U.S. military preparing for domestic disturbances. On December 23, 2008, his source was a paper titled Known Unknowns, Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development by former Army Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Fryer. Fryer wrote, quote, widespread civil violence inside the United States would force the defense establishment to reorient priorities, in extremis, to defend basic domestic order. An American government and defense establishment lulled into complacency by a long secure domestic order would be forced to rapidly divest some or most external security commitments in order to address rapidly expanding human insecurity at home. End quote. Well, maybe that's the good news. The administration finds a face-saving way to bring the troops home, citing the need for domestic security, i.e., putting down mass riots, and maybe you. Instead of the embarrassing loss of funds or belief in the U.S. dollar abroad falling away, I mean, America can't afford all those bases anyway. Going with Jim Myers' selection, quote, the Army College report states DOD might be forced by circumstances to put its broad resources at the disposal of civil authorities to contain and reverse violent threats to domestic tranquility. Under the most extreme circumstances, this might include use of military force against hostile groups inside the United States. Further, DOD would be, by necessity, an essential enabling hub for the continuing of political authority in a multi-state or nationwide civil conflict or disturbance, end quote, from the Department of Defense document. Nathan Fryer concluded that section of the report by observing, quote, DOD is already challenged by stabilization abroad. Imagine the challenges associated with doing so on a massive scale at home, end quote. Yes, indeed. But why rely on secondhand sources? The super secret document is available as a free PDF download from Strategic Studies Institute at army.mil, or buy the book for $9.99 from, well, I can't name the publisher. It's that big online company who buckled to the State Department their pressure in the WikiLeaks scandal. Army think tanker Nathan Fryer writes, quote, thus there is perhaps no greater source of strategic shock for the Department of Defense than operationalizing that component of the oath of service in a widespread domestic emergency that entails rapid dissolution of public order in all or significant parts of the United States. While likely not an immediate prospect, this is clearly a black swan that merits some visibility inside the DOD and the Department of Homeland Security. To the extent events like this involve organized violence against local, state, and national authorities and exceed the capacity of the former two to restore public order, DOD would be required to fill the gap. Friends, that is one objection to the strategy of violence. It breeds more violence and repression. The American society, and most modeled after it, have specialized in force as an export product, but the troops can always come back home. With the federal government already impotent, it isn't hard to imagine a series of riots, the shopkeepers and some of the public long for public order, a magnetic figure or an unknown army officer pops up to fill this longing. After decades of support for military dictators abroad, the United States attempts to prolong the dream of empire with a decade or two of military rule. Rome did it. Why can't we? And hey, the U.S. Armed Forces appear to understand that both peak oil and climate change are realities that can't be denied. The Army, Navy, and Air Force are looking for more and more alternative energy, being far ahead of their own government. Sad to say, but some desperate Greens might welcome a wartime-style project trying to save civilization. Derek Jensen says, civilization is the problem. I'll be in the hills growing potatoes if you need me. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Visit our website at ecoshock.org.